Hi, everybody. We're recording today's episode of Adapting on November 18th, 2022, and we're focusing today on a topic which, quite frankly, I'm not sure I wanted to deal with at all, that being the topic of death and dying in the Jewish world today and how we as Jewish educators talk about it, or actually more pointedly, don't talk about it. As you'll see in the episode, there are a few things that took place in my own experiences recently, which led me to believe that this was an important conversation to have. Talking with Rabbi Melanie Lavav becomes even more obvious as to why it's important for us to talk about death and dying, especially in the environments where we do have more control and safety and the individual relationships to deal with these issues, rather than always having to deal with them at a reactive level when perhaps grief is really coming into play. It's an important episode. It's a powerful episode. As I said, it's not one that I really expected to be having, but it could turn out to be one of the most significant and poignant episodes of Adapting that we've produced. I'm proud to be in conversation with Melanie on this particular topic. I'm sure you will all benefit from it as much as I did, both personally and professionally. And as I say these words, it's probably important for me to acknowledge that we are recording and releasing this episode on the 7th anniversary of my mother's passing, and perhaps it's as good a time as any to honor her in the production and the release of this particular episode.
This is Adapting, the Future of Jewish Education, a podcast from the Jewish Education Project, where we explore the big questions, challenges, and successes that define Jewish education. I'm David Breifman.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of Adapting. And as I've explained prior in this season, we are trying to make this season focus on issues and topics that are often difficult to talk about, some of them being more controversial opinions and some of them designed to challenge some of the bigger issues in Jewish education. But today's episode is specifically designed to talk about something which I think we avoid often talking about in Jewish education, sometimes because it's seen as being taboo or too painful to navigate, maybe in the world at large, but also in Jewish education as well. And that is the topic of death and dying. So today I am interviewing Rabbi Melanie Lavav, who is a chaplain, educator, and a certified social worker, about the work she is doing with families as their loved ones approach the end of life. Melanie brings ancient Jewish wisdom into this emotional space to help address life's most difficult questions. And I've known Melanie for quite a while in various professional capacities, and it's an absolute honor for me to be able to discuss these issues with her today. So welcome, Melanie, to today's episode.
Thanks so much, David. I'm so glad to be here with you.
So knowing just a bit about your professional journey, I'm really intrigued in asking the question of like, what got you to this part of your role in the Jewish community? And maybe more fundamentally, just describe to the audience exactly what it is that you do and how you actually got to this particular line of work.
Sure, thanks. I appreciate the question. So more than a decade ago, I started noticing in my work in a JCC setting at that time, too many families ending up in crisis as a result of the death of a family member. At the same time, when I was noticing this in my work setting, I was also helping to care for my in-laws at the end of their lives. They were both Holocaust survivors who had expressed their wishes for end of life pretty early on and often. It was a normal conversation in family. And it got me wondering about the difference between what I was seeing at work, families winding up in crisis because we weren't talking about death and dying, and my own family experience, which was different. And I wondered, what can we do differently to help families avoid or lessen the devastation of these crises? And I realized that at the heart of it was this inability to even know how to talk about death and dying. So I'm glad you've invited me here today to do exactly that. Inevitably, when I started speaking about my work, most people wind up thinking of their own experiences of loss, right? The loss of a loved one is a universal experience, the death of someone we care about. And it deserves a universal response in terms of how we in Jewish education and community life can normalize conversations about death and dying at every age and stage of life in ways that reduce fear and promote greater connection. I liken it to the conversations we have about cancer. If a generation ago, we were whispering behind closed doors the word cancer, talking in ways where we felt some shame or need for secrecy, calling it the C word. And today our kids might come home wearing pink t-shirts from their camp or school or youth group if it's Breast Cancer Awareness Day. Well, what did it take to create that change in one generation? It took brave Jewish women telling their stories, right? Advances in science like the discovery of the BRCA gene. And really, it took openly talking about it to reduce the shame and stigma. And so I believe that the same will be said in Jewish communities in the next generation, that we will gain greater confidence in talking openly about death and dying with the support of Jewish wisdom to live lives of greater meaning and connection. As far as describing what I do, it's pretty simple. By way of background, my first set of graduate degrees are in social work and Judaic studies, and 2 decades into my career, which has spanned Jewish education and Jewish communal service, I was looking for a way to pivot my focus to end-of-life care and conversations, which led me to rabbinical school at the age of 40, as I realized that what I wanted most was to be able to ground this work of talking about death and dying, to ground it deeply in Torah. And along the way, while in rabbinical school and after, continuing through today, I've also become a board-certified chaplain and a certified end-of-life doula. What I do is I run a startup nonprofit focused on helping to improve end-of-life care and conversations, inspired by, guided by Jewish wisdom. Our work is focused on curating resources in terms of helping to elevate the content that's already out there, to help people find what they need at the time they need it, in addition to creating some new content. We're convening professionals from across many disciplines, Jewish educators included, and we work as a change agent, bringing conversations about death and dying back into Jewish communal settings, such as this one, recognizing that this work in all of the settings your listeners work and play in can only help us to live with less fear.
Wow. Okay. There's a lot to digest all at once, and I want to try and unpack a lot of what you've said, and your personal journey in itself is a really interesting one as to how you got to this point. But I want to try and start the conversation about talking about death by talking about death in some ways. And I guess you and I, just as I got onto this episode pre-show, said to you, I'm really nervous about or anxious about this actual topic. And I think we all bring our personal anxieties or nervousness to these types of conversations. And in my show notes, I have the question, like, why are people so scared about talking about death? And I guess the real question is, like, why am I so scared to talk about death with you? And is this something which is just universal, or is there something that educators face that is particularly difficult about? But I want to explore why people in general find it so difficult to talk about death.
Sure. I think it is universal. And so we who identify as educators find ourselves challenged by something that most people experience. It's scary to talk about something you don't understand, right? That's it at base. It's scary to talk about what we don't really understand. I don't know how to explain it to you, what happens, right? But I do, because I've done the work to learn. So let me challenge that assumption for just a minute. Are people scared, or is it that we're not confident? Do we have our own stuff to work through, right? The loss, the grief that we continue to carry with us? Or is it that we don't have the education? Or is it that our work settings, our institutions aren't prioritizing this within the curriculum? All of this, I think, comes into play when we think about why we might avoid the topic or why we're scared to even bring it up. When people can talk about it openly, and educators can model for their students and their broader communities how to do so, so that when death does happen, it's not a crisis, then maybe we can see beyond the fear. Let me share a brief story. I was in Israel a number of years ago for the year as part of my rabbinical studies, and I went to a conference in which the great Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz was speaking, and it was on the topic of end of life. And he spoke about how we as teachers can speak about intimate things in life, which was his euphemism, as I understood it, for things like, you know, sex and relationships, because people have had those experiences and have written about them. And so even if we don't have the exact experience, there's enough out there we can educate ourselves. And yet when it comes to death and dying, nobody has gone through it and then come back to teach about it, right? So there's that piece that's missing. It's the one thing that we can't teach about from experience or relaying other people's experiences.
I think the word scared is an interesting one. You pointed it out. And this is like really irrational in terms of, like, it makes completely no sense at all, even when I say this out loud. You think if you talk about it, it's going to happen quicker, or it's going to happen to you, as if like you're bringing it on. And even though you know it's just an inevitable part of life, that you don't want to talk about it because it brings it closer than where you actually really want it to be.
Yeah, I think there's that superstition. You know, you talk about it, it's going to happen, and that it's contagious. If I get too close to other people who are talking about it, then I'm going to catch it.
So I like the story that you just told about Rabbi Steinsaltz because I think it's important. It does relate to something that I experienced when I was teaching in a day school in Australia, and there's this seventh grade curriculum about the life cycle deliberately put in place to prepare kids for their B'nai Mitzvah. And I felt fine talking about things that I had experienced or hadn't experienced. I was talking about, you know, Brit Milah and then Pidyon HaBen and then Bar and Bat Mitzvah. I was even talking about marriage ceremonies and divorce before I was married. But when it came to the episode or the curriculum piece about death, there was something at that stage of my life when I hadn't really experienced death firsthand that it became almost, I felt almost like a fraudulent teacher on the topic because there was something about teaching about death as an objective piece of Jewish ritual, which felt really distant from the actual visceral relationship that death that I later unfortunately experienced more personally in life. And I look back upon that time and said, like, there was something pedagogically going on within me, even as a teacher, that I never quite felt comfortable teaching about death until it had become more a part of my own growth and experience. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
I mean, yeah, why does that make sense? I mean, explain to me, unpack for me why it makes sense for me then.
I would imagine that by the time you were a teacher in that setting, you had been to some other life cycle events and you had done your preparation with the curricular materials. And okay, seventh graders are going to get a bit squeamish when we talk about Brit Milah, but it's something that we can assume all of the boys in the class experienced. And it's something that it has been normalized in Jewish conversations in talking about life cycle, in talking about bodies, in talking about babies, right? And then we connect it to the naming of the baby and everyone can relate to that. And we talk about, you know, where it first happened in Torah. There's a lot that are just assumptions that are part of how we talk about it. And we've seen other people do it. And when it comes to death, we don't see as many examples or practical applications of what's already in Torah, right? We don't see teachers of children focusing on those aspects of the stories in the way that we might in an adult education setting.
It's interesting. I feel like I talk about my children a bit too much on this podcast, but this morning I'm taking my son, 13 years old, to school, and he asked me, so what are you doing today? What's on the plate for work? And I said, oh, I'm going to have a conversation about death and Jewish education. And he says, why? And I said, because like, it's important. Wouldn't you prefer that your teachers talk to you about death before you need to deal with it firsthand? And he says, oh, no, that's something the rabbis have to deal with. And he didn't really see it as like the teacher's role to teach about death, but I thought it was a pretty interesting and astute observation. And by the way, we did have a passing of a relative in our family. It wasn't someone so close to our children, but we decided as a family to take my children to a Jewish funeral just recently because we thought it was important to expose them to the Jewish ritual of mourning before it really hit too close to home. And this was sort of like, I don't know, a stepping stone in some ways. And it was a really incredible family emotional experience for them to experience it firsthand. And then it made sense. But even today, that was the rabbi's job, not the educator's job. So I'm interested here that you play both of these roles here as clergy and also educator. Like, who should be talking about death? When should it be spoken about? And in what environments and context should we be talking about death?
Sure. I appreciate the perspective your son had. And I'm afraid that if we only leave it in the hands of clergy, then we're leaving out so many folks in our communities, in the greater Jewish community, for whom clergy is not a main point of contact when it comes to asking questions and learning things, right? Plenty of folks who are outside of the bonds of affiliation. I think it's important for educators to realize the opportunities we already have in the work that we do. When I think about what little I know as the parent of two kids who went through early childhood education in Jewish settings about what's called emergent curriculum, and right, the kids bring something up and then that becomes the curriculum for the week or the month and the unit. And we know that kids, you know, by the age of two, they're squishing bugs on the playground and they're looking at it, right? They find a pile of ants and they step on them. They use their fingers. They use a stick. And it's at that age that the kids don't realize that aunt is not going home for dinner that night, right? But by the age of four, and the kids are still in that Jewish early childhood context, the psychologists tell us that kids begin to understand the concept of permanency. And if kids begin to understand this idea that death is something permanent by age four, if we don't help them to see the examples in their own lives, we're missing out. I love the story you told about bringing your kids to a funeral where the stakes felt a little lower. than had it been someone with whom they had a close relationship. And I see that as a model, right? You showing us a model that we could advocate for, that if you have the opportunity, usually, you know, an even lower barrier is bring your kids to a Shiva call. Even if you didn't know the person, doesn't matter. This is what we do in community. This is how we support. And then it opens the door to talk about what happened so that the kid's first experience in going to Shiva or being in a Shiva home or going to a funeral isn't their grandparent or someone they were close to. It makes it much harder when that's the case, and it often is the case.
I actually want you to expand on this a bit further, because I also know you've had tremendous experience working with PJ Library as well and dealing with young children. And I want to ask the question, I mean, you've now spoken about four-year-olds, but the developmental appropriateness of talking about death, like you're suggesting it's that young when educators should be talking about these topics with young people today, even though it might not be the most joyous topics to be talking about. I mean, that's something hard for me to hear, but I think cognitively I get it, but it's like there's a bit of dissonance still going on there, right?
For sure, there is. And it's a conversation I think educators and parents need to be having together, right? To decide what feels right in a way that it's not necessarily a binary, either we do or we don't. It's a scary topic, it's a bad topic, it's a hard topic. It's just a topic. It's one of those things where if the kids kill a bug on the playground, well, it's an opportunity for us to talk about it. And then a kid might share, well, oh, you know, my grandparent died. And then that becomes the conversation. And what happened? It normalizes it in a way where in so many of our educational settings, the kids have things happen in their lives and we bring it into the classroom. We bring it into the educational setting. Most often, it's easy for us to celebrate the birth of a sibling or the adoption of a sibling, but we should also be acknowledging when there's a loss in the family and how to be a supportive friend. My children have gone to Jewish overnight camps, and my eldest, one summer, a few years ago, he was in a bunk where a kid's father died of a sudden heart attack, and his bunkmate went home for the funeral and the burial and a couple of days of Shiva. And then the bunkmate came back. And how could you not have a conversation in the bunk led by the counselors who knew the kids best about how we can support our friend when he comes back, about the opportunity we have to show up for him in the ways that we know how to show up. And how do we know how to show up Jewishly? Well, in this camp, they had a regular prayer practice. And so they made sure to be with the kid at those times when he needed to say Kaddish, because he was still mourning for his father. And how else could we show up for the kid? We could make sure to go out of our way, right, to ask him how he's feeling, to tell him that we missed him when he was away, to say, I'm so sorry for your loss, right? It's an opportunity to teach about the traditional response that we say in a Shiva home, HaMakom Yenachem Etchem B'toch Sha'ar Avlei Tzion V'Yerushalayim, in Hebrew, may you be comforted among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. That line is meant to help the mourner realize that they're not alone. And so I give you the example that happened in my own kids' camp bunk. It happens in Jewish schools all the time, especially with kids whose grandparents die and the kid is out for a few days and they come back. And if we don't talk about it, it's a missed opportunity. So yes, in camp, yes, on Israel trips where you're going to see the graves of the founders of the state, or the Israel trips like the one I went on when I was 17, where we went to concentration camps on the way to Israel. Of course, we're talking about death and dying at those moments.
So let's be a bit frank and honest with the audience. When I was designing the list of who I wanted to speak on this year's episodes of Adapting and the topics I wanted to cover, death and dying wasn't one of the topics. It wasn't one of the topics that I prioritized. It wasn't one of the topics that I thought was challenging enough. It actually, be frank, it didn't come even into my consciousness that it should be a topic that we talked about. Last month, you and I both had the opportunity to see a documentary which has just come out. And the documentary is called Last Flight Home. It's a movie directed by Ondi Timona, who is the sister of a good friend and colleague of ours, Rabbi Rachel Timona from Congregation Beth Elohim in Brooklyn. And the documentary is something which I'm not really prepared to say everyone should go and see it, because I'm not sure everyone's prepared for the actual documentary itself, but I strongly, strongly encourage everybody to contemplate going to see it. And it's a really powerful documentary which talks about Ondi and Rachel's father choosing to die and advocating for the end of life. And it was really a confronting documentary in so many ways. And as a result of seeing that documentary, I really then reached out to you, Melanie, and said, you know what, we can't hide from this. And it was a real eye-opening moment for me. And I think I wanted to talk to you a bit about the documentary. We'll link to it in our show notes. But there were a couple of pieces of it which I want to focus on. I don't want to focus on the end of life part itself. That's a whole topic and conversation which I don't really want to focus on in today's episode. But there were a couple of really powerful pieces of the documentary towards the end. And they're two powerful Jewish concepts or two powerful Jewish rituals as part of the death and dying process that I wanted to talk to you about. And that is the concepts of vidui and tahara. And I wanted to hear from your perspective, talk to the audience a bit about these two rituals in Jewish life and what it means and why they are so central to our understanding of death in the Jewish space.
Sure, thanks. I love the film for the ways in which the family shares so openly the realities of dying with one another and how we as the viewers have an intimate view of what those family conversations and experiences look like, especially when the person at the center of the situation who's approaching death may have a different wish than the loved ones who want nothing more than to spend more time with that person. And so I think that's, you know, another aspect of the film that I just wanted to point out. And I love, yes, as you said, how the film models the application of Jewish wisdom and practice at end of life. So vidui, you know, we know as a piece of liturgy, that's the centerpiece of our High Holiday liturgy, and it's the piece of liturgy that we use at the bedside of someone who's dying, and it's focused on forgiveness. And what we see in the film is a conversation between Rabbi Rachel Timoner and her father, in which she's asking him about some of his business failures earlier in his life and the shame that he continued to feel about those as he grew older with greater distance from when they actually happened. And what the scene points out is how burdened he felt by his failures in business. And the work that she does is really a creative adaptation of the work of the vidui, not just the recitation of a formula, but really talking about the things that had burdened him to try to free him from those non-tangible burdens so that he could move toward the end of his life in a way that he's moving through it and not carrying it with him. And I think that's an important piece about vidui. You know, we ask for forgiveness, and the liturgy that's at the heart of vidui is really about our relationship with God. There's the line that most folks know as the end of Adon Olam, Biyado Efkid Ruchi, right? In your hands do I place my spirit, right? The idea that we're trusting in God at that moment as we reach the end of our lives. And the end of it is that universal declaration of faith. We say Shema. And we say Shema, this declaration of God as one, connecting us, in my opinion, to the other ways in which we say Shema on a regular basis. Like, okay, yes, it's part of our daily prayer service, but we also have Shema al Hamita, right? We say it, or it is something that we teach about that traditionally is said as we get into bed each night. And why is that? It's part of a cycle of saying that I believe in God before I go to sleep because I'm not sure that I'm going to wake up in the morning when you think about it, right? It's no different from saying vidui at the end of life when it's going to be the end and it's the last thing that are going to be on my lips. And then when I wake up in the morning, thank God, what are the first things I say? Moda ani lefanecha. I am so grateful that I got to wake up this morning. So, you know, I think the idea of seeing how Rabbi Rachel Timoner helps her father, Eli, to work through some of the burdens that have been weighing him down, to lighten his load, is a way for us to think about bringing some kind of resolution to our lives as we approach the end.
Before we move on, I want to just talk a bit about this a bit more because I think this vidui concept is really powerful. I think it will change the way I approach the High Holidays moving forward just by being exposed to this scene in this documentary. But there was also something about, you talked about the vidui being for the person who's dying to be able to get that part off their soul, off their spirit before they pass. There was something very cathartic about the family hearing the vidui, I felt, in the documentary as well. So it was a reciprocal piece here as well. And a further element, which I think is just also interesting, perhaps for many of our listeners struggling with this concept, there was something deeply spiritual and godly and Judaic about that moment. And yet there was also something very human and God didn't necessarily have to come into that equation for everybody. And I think there was something really human and universal about that as well. And I'm wondering if you have any reflections as a conservative rabbi about the universalistic nature of Vidui as well.
Sure. When I teach about Vidui, I talk about it by asking the question, what's the last thing you say before you go to sleep at night? And often if, you know, you're an adult and you have a bed partner, it might be good night, or it might be I love you, or it might be I'm sorry. Or if you're a parent and you have children, right, you kiss them goodnight. What is it that you say? I love you. I'm sorry, right? See you in the morning. I'm really proud of you, right? What are the last things we say before we say goodbye at night? And this is an opportunity, a universal opportunity to think about what are the last things we want to say. And the universal opportunity is really to clear our souls from the things that have been holding us back. You know, the scene in the movie is so touching in the way that Rachel is asking her father questions to elicit specific responses on this difficult topic. And her sister, Andy, the filmmaker, right, she jumps in and she's trying to like help her father with the words and reiterate what he's saying and, you know, say what she thinks he means. And Rachel stops her, says, no, the point of the exercise here is to have him talk about it, or however she responds. And, you know, that scene is familiar to many of us who have siblings, of each of us wanting nothing more than to make it better and to do it in our own way. And, you know, Rachel, with her rabbinic authority, wins that argument in the moment and allows her father to finish this cathartic moment as part of this creative approach to Vidui.
And then the scene moves after Eli's passing into one of a form of tahara, a form of ritual purity of preparing the body before the funeral. And I want to talk a bit about that because I think of all the parts of death that we don't want to talk about, I think tahara could be up there with them. And touching a dead body has a whole lot of like squeamishness maybe that's associated with it as well. This documentary made it very powerful message to the audience about this could be one of the highest forms of respect and dignity one can ever give to a human being by going through this process of tahara. And I want you to talk a bit about what tahara means and why it becomes so powerful in the Jewish mourning and the dying cycle, I guess. Yeah.
Sure. So traditionally, tahara is ritual purification. It's this idea of preparing the body for burial in a specific ritual way. Traditionally, it's done by a team of volunteers who are usually members of the Chevra Kedisha, the Sacred Burial Society, who traditionally have worked under the cover of night and don't go about announcing that this is what they do in their spare time to preserve the dignity of the one who has died and the work that they do. And there's a specific set of liturgical words and formulas that are recited. Otherwise, you know, the rest of the time is spent in silence, preserving the dignity of the body, washing it, covering it so that you're washing, you know, only the hand at the moment, only the hand is uncovered at the moment that you're washing the hand, really focused on elevating the dignity of the body of the person who has died. And what we see in the film is the family taking the first steps to wash Eli's body after he takes his last breath, right? We see them wiping him down gently with cloths, with water, with wipes. And this is equivalent to the washing, the actual just washing the body that is done by the Chevra Kedisha in the tahara process. Now, tahara traditionally now, it takes place in the funeral home. Most funeral homes where Jewish funerals take place have a room where it is done with, you know, access to water and equipment for, you know, cleaning under the nails and things like that. What we see in the film is the family taking on the responsibility for washing their father's body at home, which is a little bit different and helps to, I think, to normalize this idea that we want to take care of the person, even up until the moment that we're going to then dress their body to be buried. When you think about a baby being born, the baby comes into the world in a way where it's covered with things, with substances, with fluids, and that's natural and it's normal. And after the baby's cries and the health checks, the baby's taken for a few moments and washed, gently washed, and then wrapped up in a little blanket as a package and handed to the parents, right? We are doing the same at the end of life as we've done at the beginning of life.
Wow. So I know this visual doesn't make for good podcasting, but throughout this episode, my shoulders have relaxed. I've become a bit less tense. I've felt myself like morphing into the conversation and learning and feeling almost my own ease or, you know, barriers being taken down as we've begun to speak today. So I think this is all evidence in proof time that talking about death really does benefit both the talker and the recipient and the listener. Hopefully for all of you out there as well, you've also gained a different perspective on talking about death in a Jewish context and within Jewish education. Melanie, before we leave, I want to ask a question that I've asked of all of my guests since we began the Adapting series, and that is for you to be able to pay tribute to an educator in your life who has made some sort of impact on you.
Sure. So Howard Wasserman, may his memory be a blessing, hired me in my first full-time Jewish educator job to join him in working in the Russian-speaking emigre community, where he was then director of a JCC in the 90s. And it was work that had a profound impact on who I am and how I see the world, most especially in my commitment to making Jewish life and Jewish wisdom accessible beyond requirements for affiliation or membership. Howard was my teacher in life. But even in his death, and that's why I chose him, knowing you were going to ask this question, I wasn't in touch with him in his last years. But apparently he told his family that he wanted a specific song played at his funeral. And so I attended his funeral, and much to my tearful surprise, as his body was being wheeled out of the funeral home on the way to burial at the cemetery, we sang along as they piped in the Beatles' Here Comes the Sun. And it really stayed with me. This idea that even in our death, we can continue to educate.
Melanie, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today and this episode. And also, really, a thank you for the work that you're doing. I've learned so much from you in just this episode and also after hearing you on another podcast recently as well. And it got me more engrossed in the actual materials and curriculum that you're providing. I do find your whole discussion in the beginning about where we were 10 years ago in terms of talking about cancer and now it's become more normalized, a really powerful invocation of like, this is the beginning of something and that you're a real trailblazer in this discussion. And I really just want to commend you and your courage, your bravery, your strength, your passion for this topic is something that I think we should all learn from and just be inspired by. So thanks for sharing this time with us today.
Thank you, David.
Today's episode of Adapting was produced by Dina Nussenbaum and Miranda Lapidus, and the show's executive producers are myself, Karen Cummins, and Nessa Lieben. Our show, as always, is engineered and edited by Nathan J. Vaughan of NJV Media. If you enjoyed today's episode of Adapting and the entire season, please leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, and even better still, share it with a friend. In particular, this episode I'm sure will have meaning for many people in your circles, so please make sure that you bring it to their attention so they can benefit from it as much as I have. To learn more about the Jewish Education Project, please visit our website at jewishedproject.org, where you can learn more about our mission, history, and staff. And be sure to click on the part of the website which talks about our educator portal. We will have many resources available to talk about some of the issues which we covered in today's conversation about death and dying in Jewish education. As always, we're a proud partner of UJA Federation of New York, and I want to thank you all for listening today. Thanks, everyone, for their support. Have a great day.